then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's February 19th, 2015. I'm Andy Donner, and you're listening to Radio Free Northwest.
Passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely croon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Hi guys, this is Harold Covington speaking on Valentine's Day. And I'd just like to have a brief opening word on this third episode of Radio Free Northwest, which has been produced by Andy Donner, to let you folks out there know that, no, I haven't disappeared or fled screaming into the night. I haven't been arrested. I haven't had a heart attack or been abducted by aliens or any of the other rumors that have been floating around on the internet. I usually spend about 2.5 cumulative days between Monday and Wednesday of every week working on RFN. Now, some of our pre-ANN listeners may recall my occasional past complaints about these incidents that keep coming up where I have to drop everything and deal with something right away, personally. Well, after 5 years of keeping the show coming out regularly once a week, the inevitable finally happened. Something came up that was unavoidable, and the fact is that I really didn't have the time to devote to the show those weeks, or at least not to do it properly. Now, I'm not going to get into details about that except to say that it is something that in the long run is going to be a good thing for the NF and for the Northwest Independence Movement. It was something that had to happen sooner or later and now turned out to be the time. But it was something that I simply had to take care of personally, and it's been pretty labor and time intensive. Yeah, I could have just slapped something together and uploaded it, but it would have been pretty obvious that I was just phoning it in. And with the 15 to 20,000 new listeners we have for the show, courtesy of Rodney Martin and the All Nationalist Network, that wouldn't have been fair, and it wouldn't have looked very good. At this crucial moment, Andy Donner stepped up, and I think he's done a great job. In fact, now that I know that if need be, I'm not shackled to my computer for 2.5 days every week doing the show, some other good things may become possible. For example, I may be able to take a road trip or two this summer and get out and around the homeland and start meeting people on their own ground rather than making them come trudging all the way up to Seattle to meet with me here. Now, Andy's volunteered to do one more show this week, basically, I think, just to give me a break, but I'll be back next week. There are some other things that we're going to be doing on RFN over the coming months, including some new software and technical stuff, and we're going to look into the possibility of maybe doing a call-in show once a month, either separately or as a weekly episode, so you guys might let me know what you think about that idea. Anyway, like I said, I'll be back next week, and I'd like to thank Andy and all the contributors and panelists who have helped over the past couple of shows. Good work, guys. Sasha on the button.
With the recent growth of the Radio Free Northwest audience, the party is likely to experience an increase in a long-term communication problem. Quite a few of you contact the party and don't get the reaction you expect. From here on out, this is going to have to serve as my canned answer when this problem comes up. I'm going to address getting in the party's good graces and the value of your contributions. This is yet another one of those talks where at least half the audience is going to think I'm referring to them specifically. Unless someone does something utterly retarded in public, we hardly ever call them out. Don't worry, I'm not talking about you. This goes doubly for today, since this applies to so very many of you. Most of the communication we receive heavily relies on phrases such as, I'm a white nationalist, I support the party, I completely agree with the NF, I Want to Move to the Northwest, and a series of others. To be perfectly clear from the get-go, I'm not calling you a liar. Not by a long shot. As always, enthusiasm is good, and I have no reason to question someone's sincerity. I fully realize most of you are trying to express your interest and appreciation for what we're up to. While not lost on us, this sort of thing usually fails to attract our attention. To be completely honest, it's so very common for someone to talk this way without ever doing anything other than talk. Talk, as the saying goes, is cheap. Usually, these sorts of shibboleths are followed by a request for some sort of special treatment or help which we can't give. Sometimes, they're blatant manipulation, which only causes us to be more skeptical of their use in general. Harold has had several occasions on Radio Free Northwest to mention people who promise they're coming home next year. This is all perfectly fine until next year rolls around, and the promise is still next year. It just so happened that I had cause to find out about one of these next year people who recently moved to Oregon. Welcome home, comrade. To be sure, this does happen more and more as time goes on. I'm fully aware some of you out there are the real deal, and demonstrate yourselves as such. The problem is, we can't tell who these people will be until after the fact. All the nice words ahead of time don't actually tell us anything. Again, enthusiasm is great, and your interest is always appreciated. Just understand why the party doesn't fawn over people for invoking one of the shibboleths. Before I move on, there's one other far worse and grossly offensive, though much less common, sort of thing said to the party and those involved in the Northwest Imperative. As dismissive as this might sound, just remember this. Those who have made the migration have room to talk. I would also politely remind you that you don't join the party. The party joins you. I'm often told, by people who are not in any way affiliated with us, what some mythical we needs to do. We is never given a concrete definition, but I suspect it refers to white people, or perhaps only white nationalists. It certainly doesn't refer to these people and the party, because there's no we there. I'm not trying to be elitist or aloof or anything else. It's just a fact. I completely understand and empathize with the desire to feel involved, but remember the Class A white nationalist definition I played last week. We need to think, not feel. Feelings are a perfectly valid tool when used correctly. Correct use of feelings, however, does not include being so rude as to include yourself in a group to which you have not been admitted. If you really do think you need on the proverbial membership list, the trucker has made it clear what you need to do. This feeling of involvement is actually a bad thing if you're not truly contributing, since you'll chase the feeling rather than the reality. If you find the party unwilling to reciprocate your comradely feelings, please understand there's a good reason for it, and it's ultimately to your benefit. Since I've moved on to the territory of contributions, I detect a distinct difference between what is said and what is done. Recall the I support the NF shibboleth. Do you really support the NF, or is this just a declaration of ideological solidarity? I ask because there's a contingent of our long-time listener base which claims to support us using nothing but words. As it turns out, these words don't end up contributing anything or significantly altering the narrative surrounding white nationalism or the Northwest Imperative. I need to get the issue of money out of the way. I'm personally comfortable talking about the party's money because I don't receive any of it, and I have no desire to do so. Yes, money is substantial, and our financial supporters are very deeply appreciated. I'm not here to guilt you all into financially supporting the NF, but the subject is relevant, because money can be put towards our goals while emotional support cannot. Now, about these words. Are they really as valuable as you think they are? This same subject came up a few months after I found the Northwest Front, and Harold had to send out an email reminding people about those incredibly long messages he doesn't have time to answer. In addition, there's also a tendency among people writing those emails to expect a large amount of correspondence in return, even though this doesn't service anyone's racial objectives. Somebody out there got their feelings hurt by Harold's email and responded, to which he publicly followed up. What it boiled down to is that this guy wanted to make a contribution to the Northwest Front by passing along perfectly obvious and well-known facts about firearms. I'm by no means a firearm expert, and never will be, and at the time I knew nothing about guns. Even then, his input didn't tell me anything I couldn't deduce through a few seconds of thought. His not-quite-contribution, he was so proud of, was utterly useless, and despite this, he still expected a pat on the head for it. Believe it or not, this sort of content is what makes up the bulk of white nationalism today, and in retrospect, I probably shouldn't be surprised so many repeat it to us thinking we're going to be impressed. Throughout my involvement with the party, the most common thing I'm approached with is the insistence that white people need racial solidarity. Okay, so they do, but that's a given, and it's part of the core idea of white nationalism. It doesn't say anything that hasn't already been said. I tend to go along with this sort of thing long enough to propose the Butler Plan. That usually kills the conversation. The same thing happens when someone gets on my case about how white people need a plan. Duh. There's also another quite common declaration that white people need a racial identity. I don't think you've noticed, but we have one. Again, please don't get me wrong here. It's great that someone has come to these conclusions, and when I have the chance, I try to encourage these people in the right direction. The problem is that these observations, valid though they may be, are all entailed by the very concept of white nationalism. These so-called contributions contribute nothing other than, again, the feeling of having accomplished something. It's encouraging, though just barely, that so many of you feel the need to act, but the only act you ever engage in is finding other white nationalists on the internet and telling them things they already know. And on the subject of action, there's a now-defunct movement group who, up to a couple of years ago, went on and on about nothing but making sure everyone was active, whatever that means. Again, duh. That was the extent of their presentation, too. Everyone needed to be active. TBU, folks. True, but useless. Lastly, the party sometimes has to comment on incredibly stupid, ill-advised, and downright harmful behavior, both on and off the internet. Whether it be open illegality, exposing your identity to the public, character failures, religious feuds, or anything else which squanders effort and the meager resources available to our movement, we've got to call it like we see it. There's not really any other way to say what I have to say other than pointing out that stupid things should be avoided since they do nothing but harm. This is the sort of thing where a personal anecdote fits best, since pulling real-life examples out of the movement is guaranteed to be considered fighting a feud. When I was a small child, though not so small that I couldn't get myself into a fair amount of trouble, I noticed my family needed to make use of a number of objects which had become tangled in various cords, cables, and netting in our garage. I got it in my head that I would be helpful and sort the mess out. Okay, that would have been helpful, but I decided to do it in the worst way possible, with scissors. I was young, sure, but not so young that I couldn't have thought this plan through enough to realize property destruction isn't actually helpful. But I didn't. My mother caught me, and I earned myself an ass-whipping. I couldn't understand why at the time, since I was only trying to be helpful. After all, my intentions were good. She was just being mean and a bully. Or was she? I was so busy being mad at how wronged I had been that I didn't even realize I was fully able to prevent what happened by merely thinking about the consequences of my choices. I was, in retrospect, just old enough to have understood that scissors make permanent changes to objects being cut. It was appropriately childish of me to have been angry at being punished, even though I did something I shouldn't have. And with that story out of the way, I must observe it is inappropriately childish for adults in the white nationalist movement to become cross with the party for calling out destructive, risky, stupid, or wasteful behavior, well-intentioned though it may be. Yet when Harold, myself, or someone else is required to issue harsh commentary on something, the whole damn movement recoils in shock and horror at not being allowed to wallow in its own white trash filth. Why, in God's name, when we all presumably have a sound mind with which to work and at least a little bit of life experience to draw on? I've just listened to my monologue for the day, and I realize I had to edit it somewhat harshly, but I needed to shave it down. This segment has already run long, and I really need to fit in a guest submission before getting on with the main portion of the program, so I had to cut from somewhere. I apologize if that came across as a bit hard to listen to. Anyway, Harold has periodically played music which he listened to while writing the Northwest Independence novels, and I've decided this week I'm going with those songs as a musical theme for our breaks. This is Bare Naked Ladies.
Hours go shorter as the days go by. We never get to stop and open our eyes. 1 minute you're waiting for the sky to fall, and next you're dazzled by the beauty of it all. Time. Lovers in a dangerous time. These fragile bodies of touch and taste, this fragrant skin, this hair like lace, spirits open to a thrust of grace. Never a breath you can afford to waste. Lovers in a dangerous time. Lovers in a dangerous time. Time.
Hello, friends. I think it was the very first time that Harold played a little clip of mine on his show that I was talking about competing circles of power behind the scenes in our society. I've just been thinking about that a little bit more lately. And one thing that I keep thinking about is all these generals that Obama has laid off. He's changed the head of the CIA a couple of times. He just sacked the head of Guantanamo, and that was like last week, and they're talking about prosecuting Petraeus. And I think you can see in these actions an attempt by the left, the cultural Marxist elite left, the one-worlders, the globalists, to cut the head off of the military-industrial complex. So I think that whether we like it or not, the military-industrial complex is the only power in America that could potentially challenge the globalists and their agenda. And I think that's why they're being reshuffled like that. I mean, it's a purge. It's not likely, with media being as controlled as it is and the universities as controlled as they are, that we would ever see a grassroots revolution in this country that would change the current regime or change the dynamics of our society. It's too controlled. So grassroots is out, which I think is why Harold has the plan of fall back to the Northwest and regroup from there, which I think probably in the long run, with whatever may happen in the future regarding the rise of China and proliferation of nuclear weapons, it could actually save your life to get out of the big cities. But back to my point about the military-industrial complex, you know, in Chile, there was a right-wing dictator named Pinochet who seized power. And he ousted the corrupt Democrats, or the so-called democracy, I think there was at the time. It could have been a socialist regime. Those South American countries are often socialist. But anyway, there's precedent for a military takeover. And I grew up on an army base, and I liked it. You know, there is a feeling of order, and whether it's true or not, you have a perception of morality, you know, a code of behavior. I liked it. I would not mind living under a military dictatorship. And I think that the military-industrial complex must realize that their power cannot be perpetuated forever under the current reality. Just like the Roman legions became weaker once they were only partially Roman and full of non-Romans, the U.S. military is not going to be the same military whenever it's full of Mexicans and third worlders trying to get their citizenship by doing a term of service. I mean, that is exactly what the Romans did. And we are exactly overextended like they are and unsupported like they were. So I just think if they're going to do it, they must realize that this is not the America the founders envisioned. You can no longer vote your way out of the situation here. It's going to drift further and further to the left because the left promises the lower class goodies. And they're just going to vote themselves more and more goodies. And that, which is why the founding fathers decreed that only white male property owners could vote. But the right to vote has been disseminated to everybody. You can't even ask if they're a citizen in a lot of places. So having the right to vote for everyone is a terrible, terrible thing, because get a lot of dumbasses voting for whoever's going to give them a free cell phone. So by restricting it to white male property owners, they made sure that the electorate was knowledgeable about the topics and is not in a needy position of needing material from the government, needing money or welfare or whatever, although they didn't have a welfare system. So I just hope that if there is this military-industrial complex, and if by some chance in some cubicle somewhere in the Defense Intelligence Agency there is an analyst listening to this podcast, I hope you realize that some of us would actually want you to do a coup and get rid of this mobocracy that has happened here in the United States. And I know you're pinning all your hopes on a military-friendly Republican taking office next time around, but even if you get that, and even if you get the support you need, and even if everything goes overseas the way you need it to go to sustain yourself, your military-industrial complex, your vast machine, if the home front's not right, ain't nothing going to be right. The Department of Homeland Security is not enough. Cannot treat a cancer that's growing in the United States with the Department of Homeland Security. We need to somehow reshuffle who is the decision makers in this country? And it cannot be the takers whenever the takers outnumber the makers. Personally, I like the former government envisioned in the novel Starship Troopers. I think it was Heinlein who devised it, where only citizens could vote. And in order to be a citizen, you had to do a term of service, either in the military or some sort of civil service. And that by doing that, you showed that you were placing the good of the nation over yourself. Because if the right to vote is just willy-nilly given away to everyone who just happens to not die before they turn 18 and who gets most of their information from mainstream controlled news, we are just going to become more and more decadent, more and more a melting pot that isn't really melting together, and it won't last. The other thing that's interesting about the former government that Heinlein envisioned in Starship Troopers, you have a two-tier form of government. You have legal residents and citizens, and like I said, citizens are people who have done military service or civil service. So what that ensures is it's almost a revolution-proof form of government, because in order to have an armed revolution in a country, you need people who are willing to take up arms. Well, the people who are trained in arms and willing to take up arms already have the right to vote because they've done it. So by ensuring that the people who are military-minded have the right to vote, the people who are selfless and willing to struggle for the society have the right to vote, you're eliminating the potential for conflict there, so that your voter base is made up of the type of people who would potentially overthrow the government if it wasn't working right. So they're franchised, and the takers, the ones who would not lift a finger to overthrow anything, they just want Mo, they are disenfranchised. So I thought that was pretty interesting form of government that he proposed there. I guess technically that's considered fascism, but I'm not sure about that. But anyway, who cares what it's called as long as it works.
I apologize to our regular guest speakers, but I needed to make room for the bulk of this program. Next week, we should be able to start processing the backlog of submissions you've sent us. This week, for the Back to Basics material, I'm going to play various clips of Harold talking about the White Enclave solution, also known as the Amish solution or Beaver Cleaverville, so that it's covered for the ANN audience. This episode of RFN is about to go lopsided unless I stick in another music break. I apologize for the short segment, but this ended up being the best arrangement I could come up with. This is Cyndi Lauper.
Afraid of the dark, I can't. I was fearless. Could I be your reckless friend? And if I was helpless, could you be the one comes rushing in?
John from Chicago writes, Dear HAC, I've listened to your excellent Radio Free Northwest podcasts and have read samples of your inspiring novels. I'd like for you to consider commenting on an essay by Yost Turner, Back to the Land, where Yost presents action of simply getting away from the system and setting up white folk communities in the mountains, the Northwest, wherever, other areas. Yost's plan is to simply do it, not talk, complain, wave guns, do revolutionary fantasies with middle-aged men waving assault rifles in the air and taking videos of themselves, boasting about violent revolutions and posting the videos on YouTube, complete with personal contact information, so forth and so on. I would also like for you to consider commenting on the Amish in America now, what they're doing. I have read reports that their numbers have doubled since the 1970s. Keep the faith and let's do it. Signed, John in Chicago. Okay, John, I'll do my best to answer your query, although I warn you, you may not like what you hear. I think I've gotten into this in a few previous episodes of Radio Free Northwest, but that's okay. I'm glad to do it again. As I've said before, a lot of these podcasts are going to consist of varied repetition of what's been said before, because there are a few serious and urgent major points that our people must come to understand and internalize. This is one of these questions where I'm going to have to pick and choose my words very carefully, because it's vitally important that I not be perceived as denigrating or ragging on a particular individual group or point of view. God knows I don't want to be starting any more lifelong blood feuds over a point like this, and there is enough goat dancers on the internet calling me a Jew and a black magician and extraterrestrial and whatnot already. But it's necessary to address this idea, which is very widespread among white nationalists, that somehow we will be allowed by the regime to withdraw from the politically correct world, that somehow we can get away with not participating in all the madness. We can't. It's a lovely dream, John. It is, really. But it ain't going to happen for a number of reasons. There have always been a number of diverse tendencies within the movement, if you'll pardon my use of that term, and one of them has always been the idea of some kind of unilateral separation from Zion, but without any political element, without any Second Amendment element, without any attempt to confront and wrest state power away from the people who seek to do us such harm. I find it ironic that we in the Northwest Migration are the ones who are always getting accused of running away. This country is still big enough, and there's still enough empty land out there to where it would be theoretically possible to go off somewhere and live on our own, like the Amish do in John's example, to deliberately turn our backs on the filth and diversity and poison of the modern American world. Now, this is essentially what the Pioneer Little Europe, or PLE, thing is about, if anyone ever were to actually do it. The quick answer to this I can give you in two words. Ruby Ridge. Ask Randy Weaver how well his attempt to take himself and his family out of the world of political correctness, MTV, and Soylent Green worked out for him. They won't let us do it, John. It is no longer enough just to burn a pinch of incense before the altars of the false gods of political correctness and then have done with it and go on and live our lives. Now we must dance before the altars as well, and everybody must dance. No one can be exempt. When the two-minute hate comes around, everybody must shout and shout loud. For those of you who snidely respond, well, Harold, what makes you think they'll let us all move to the Northwest and make our own country there? Yeah. My answer is, if you will read the Northwest novels, I very clearly show you what the difference is. We have no intention of going to Zog with hats in hand and humbly pleading with them to be nice and leave us alone. Remember the old Sicilian proverb, "Don't tacere, c'è cosa non potete prendere." Don't ask for what you can't take. Liberals and political correctness can't survive on their own. Liberalism and all leftism is basically a power trip. Liberals seek power over other human beings, for our own good, of course. In order for the liberal way to exist at all, it must have state power, because the essence of liberalism is forcing other people to be good, or their definition of good. Forcing other people to be diverse and not drive large SUVs and not eat salt or McDonald's hamburgers. Liberalism is like a big nanny who must always be stopping us little white children from doing what we want to do because it's bad for us, and nanny knows best. Take away nanny's power by removing ourselves from her authority, and what reason does she have for existing? If white people were to be allowed to voluntarily opt out of the system, then what reason would the system have for existing? Even if we were to successfully exercise some kind of Amish option, so to speak, and create our own little slice of all-white paradise, eventually we would come to the notice of the authorities, and there would be FBI or some other kind of government officials on our doorsteps to fuck with us. They could never allow such a thing to exist. It would strike at the very heart of their power. By the way, at this point I should mention that all of this is just theoretical in any case. Other than a small trickle of people who are actually coming home to the Northwest, nobody's actually moving anywhere or doing any of this, so the point's moot. But unfortunately, movement people squabble just as bitterly over moot points and obscure bits of doctrine as any Jesuit or Christian tub-thumper does. Anyway, Zog's approval or disapproval aside, we also run into our old nemesis here, character. I've referred to this go-off-in-the-woods-or-take-over-some-small-town idea as PLE in previous podcasts, but okay, for the sake of John's question this time around, let's refer to it as the Amish option. The idea, or some variation of it, depending on who's talking, is that we locate and buy some cheap land way, way, way out in the boonies someplace, be it Northwest or West Texas or the Appalachian Mountains or wherever. Now, this presupposes that there will be actual money behind the project, and that's usually where it falls down in the real world. We'll gab about this kind of thing for years on end on the internet, but I've noticed that the checkbooks always remain firmly closed. No one cares to lay out any actual cash that could be spent in the city on beer and consumer goods. Yost Turner, whom I knew, did indeed make one of the few actual attempts at such a commune back in the 80s and 90s, which he called the NS Kindred, is up around Nevada City, California. But Yost actually owned some land, one of the last of us who ever did, I believe. Land that he purchased with his life savings from working at an actual real-world job, which virtually none of us have anymore thanks to Bush's Wall Street buddies, and which we never will have again thanks to Obama. Now, that's how Pastor Butler originally bought the Hayden Lake compound as well, with real money from his retirement from a real job in aerospace back in California, but I digress. Anyway, in theory, once someone comes up with a large amount of money and we buy a large tract of land out in Devil's Outhouse, Wyoming, or wherever, then we supposedly get together a group of white people and go to this place and live on little farms like our ancestors in the pioneer days, make all our own necessities, not have any TVs in our homes, which is a good idea in any case, and we just quietly vegetate away in our little corner of white paradise while the rest of the North American continent goes to hell all around us. Well, lots of luck with that, John. For years now, I have been attempting to get white people, supposed white nationalists now, to pack the moving van and come here to the Northwest. We're not trying to get them to move to some little cabin in the woods and live by kerosene lamps at night, either. We offer some of the most beautiful and clean cities remaining in the country. You get here on interstate highways. We've got nice suburban homes if you've got the money to buy them. All the modern conveniences and comforts, including the internet and cable TV and fast food takeout if you're so inclined. And we still can't get more than a comparative handful to pack that moving van. Some, yeah. More than last year, yeah. But when you count organic migration and the potential those people have, we're actually doing better here in the Northwest than it looks at first glance. But getting so-called white nationalists to get up off their asses and move somewhere, anywhere, seems to be almost the very definition an impossible task. Getting white people of any kind to move anywhere for any reason besides offering them money seems to be impossible. Oh, sure, if you pay them, they'll come in droves. The Libertarians haven't gotten more than a couple of dozen people to move to New Hampshire for their migration, and the Bible Thumpers apparently haven't had too much more success with their South Carolina migration. And by the way, John, I noticed from your email that you yourself are still living in Chicago. What's up with that? I at least made my migration. I'm here in the Northwest. A similar sidetrack is the Beaver Cleaverville idea, the idea that we find some little isolated town in Idaho or wherever and build a 1950s theme park complete with white bread, Ozzie Nelson cardigans, Bobby socks, some good old-fashioned whitewashed Protestant churches for Sundays, the red, white, and blue, and the whole Pat Boone scenario. That's also known as the Brady Bunch fantasy, i.e. the idea that we can somehow turn back the clock. The trouble is, that's not possible. And the problem is, as I've just said, they won't let us do it in any case. Folks, I get it. Believe me, I do. There are a lot of people out there who share this dream. I know. I talk to them online every day. These folks want to create Beaver Cleaverville, and I get that 100%. It's a white thing. It means they have good racial instincts. The white man has a long pastoral history of living on small farmsteads and in very small towns, which provide a few simple goods and services. It's a good way of life, one that's natural to us. I understand that. It was like that for the first 150 years or so in this country before capitalism and the Jews began economically squeezing us all into the cities where we could be more easily controlled and where they could profit from our labor. And for many generations, white Americans have been seeking some way to escape back into this wonderful time we seem to remember in our chromosomes. But we can't. Folks, I don't know how else to say this. The clock of history and human events runs forward. Always. It cannot be turned back. The past is the past. We have to start looking to the future, and we have to accept that that future is going to be a lot different from what we might want it to be. The North American continent now contains massive numbers of completely unassimilable non-whites who do not share this dream and who will never share it, and who will never fit into any such scenario. Remember, there were no mosques or taco stands or nigger gangbangers in the Beaver's hometown, and the Brady Bunch never had to deal with crack cocaine or sodomy. Well, at least not on the television screen. The actors were a different story, but we won't get into that. Whether we like it or not, those things and worse are what America is all about these days, and the dirt can't be scrubbed or vacuumed or sandblasted away. Then there is the uncomfortable truth that if anyone ever did succeed in creating Beaver Cleaverville in some small valley here in Idaho or in Alabama or anywhere else, eventually the lumbering thugs in the body armor with the automatic weapons would come. They would make up some excuse like they did with the Branch Davidians or the Texas Mormons or the Weaver family. The United States Marshals and FBI will come in the dawn and drag the Cleavers away into living hell because, as I say again, the only way that any American version of the liberals' brave new world will ever work is if everybody participates either voluntarily or by force, because the brave new world of the liberals is so utterly repugnant to the human spirit that if you give people an out, they will eventually take it, and nobody will be left in the wonderful new paradise for people like Rahm Emanuel and Arianna Huffington and Al Franken and John Stewart to lord it over and feel superior to, and we can't have that now, can we? The United States of America has proven time and again that they will brutally punish anyone who tries to separate themselves from the brave new world of Bill and Hillary Clinton and Barack Hussein Obama. Ask Bill White. Ask Edgar Steele. And if you dare to resist, their snipers will gun you down in your own doorway like they did to Vicky Weaver. And they'll burn your home to the ground with you and your family inside, just like they did the Branch Davidians. I know it's been 17 years since Waco, but to me it's like yesterday, and I know all of you must have seen the video footage. I don't know how anybody can watch that burning compound with the children inside all those years ago and not get the message, but apparently an awful lot of our people don't. Folks, we can indeed build such a white paradise here in the Pacific Northwest, but first we have a revolution to win. There can be no hope for white people without a nation-state of our own, only for us. We can indeed create your Beaver Cleaverville many times over, but only once we have removed the evil people who now rule us and taken our political and racial destiny back into our own hands. We must someday confront the United States and its armed men, and we must begin preparing for that day now. Guys, if you learn nothing else from anything I have ever written or said, burn this into your brains. Nothing can be accomplished without state power in our hands, not theirs. Somehow, sometime, we must find within ourselves the courage and the will to confront the powers of darkness and defeat them. There's no way out, no matter how we may try to wriggle and rationalize our way off the hook. At some point, we fight, or someday, we die. All of us.
Next music break. I admit this isn't exactly Northwest novel theme music, but it was quoted to open Chapter 6 of The Hill of the Ravens, and has been referred to extensively on this program in the past. This is the Wolf Tones.
Oh, Father, why are you so sad on this bright Easter morn? When Irishmen are proud and glad of the land that they were born. Oh, son, I see in memory too of far off distant days, when being just a lad like you, I joined the IRA.
Where are the lads who stood with me when history was made? Oh, Gromagree, I long to see the boys of the old brigade.
From hills and farms, the call to arms was heard by one and all. And from the glen came brave young men to answer Ireland's call. Was long ago we faced the foe, the old brigade and me. And by my side they fought and died that Ireland might be free.
Where are the lads who stood with me when history was made? Oh, Gromagree, I long to see the boys of the old brigade.
Why on Easter morn I sigh, for I recall my comrades all of dark old days gone by. I think of men who fought in glens with rifle and grenade. May heaven keep the men who sleep from the ranks of the old brigade.
Where are the lads who stood with me when history was made? Oh, Gromagree, I long to see the boys of the old brigade. Where are the lads who stood with me when history was made? Oh, Gromagree, I long to see the boys of the old brigade.
Here's part two of the panel discussion, which began airing last week.
Oh, well, they've got to justify their budget.
They've got to justify their budget, of course. Harold often says you can't have anti-terrorism without terrorism, and when there's no terrorism going on, you have to gin some up, so to speak.
Well, who's the biggest terrorist in the world?
Israel.
Followed by the United States government.
Yes. At the behest of Israel, no less.
Of course.
I generally don't get into conspiracy theory, even though as a field I completely feel it's justified. And I've gone over that previously on Radio Free Northwest. But one thing I noticed, I happened to be at home the day of the Boston bombings. And I happened to be online right as they happened. And that was especially interesting to me because not 5 minutes into it, people who at least claim, and as far as I know they're telling the truth, but people who claim to be white nationalists were all over it with newsreel footage and stills off of just the mainstream media and everything, showing that there was a serious problem with this attack. Because the backpacks that the Boston-baked bombs were in,
yes,
were being carried by a couple of guys that looked like military or ex-military or perhaps, you know, private contractor or
yes,
whatever. But we end up blaming these, and not that I have no love for Muslims, just get it out of your system, people, but these, what were their names?
Sarnev? Yeah.
The Tsarnaev brothers were eventually chased down. One of them was gunned down for planting these bombs, and it's pretty obvious they didn't do it because there's media footage of, you know,
the
military...
The color of the backpacks didn't match either.
Right.
The ones that they had were one color. I think they were light or white, and the other one was
dark.
Black.
Yeah.
It doesn't match up. The evidence doesn't fit.
Well, that, and it got even worse because, and by that time, the Newport shootings hadn't happened yet, or the Newtown shootings out east hadn't happened yet. And that ties into this as well because I don't remember the sequence of these events exactly all that well, but.
I know Sandy Hoax was before the Boston Bake
Bombs. Sandy Hoax was before the Boston Bake Bombs?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, in addition, the shooting in Aurora, Colorado, in what was that, 2012? Would have been April 2012, I think, is when that was. All of the news actors, well, that's what they are. They were actors, but all of the people.
Crisis actors
is what they're called. There are stills and video footage of people who were like, oh, let's hold up the picture of this person that was killed in this attack, and her family is here, and they're grieving, and whatever else. And there were, you know, some security guards or private security contractors of some sort that responded to this event. Those same contractors were the guys who actually carried the bombs in the Boston bombing. And there were people on the news in Boston who were supposedly killed during the Aurora shooting. The Aurora, Colorado shooting is a Denver suburb. The same thing happened for the Sandy Hoax, where, again, you have the same disaster actors that had been deployed, but just in different roles, and badly photoshopped pictures of children where, oh, that little girl on this person's lap has no legs because they photoshopped it badly or something. And this is on the news of, this little girl was killed in the whatever, and then months later, she's mysteriously being hugged by President Obama in the White House for, you know, some other act. Like, oh, the amount
Look,
of...
Look, Mommy, it's a talking monkey!
No, well, that's... I'm pretty sure she's been told not to say things like that. But if you think this is fake, or I'm joking about this, or whatever, I'm not inclined towards conspiracy theory. It's just that after so many events happened in such rapid succession, you can compare the mainstream media coverage of these events and see that, oh my God, none of this is real. This is all staged.
Yeah, there's so much evidence that it's not real. It's so exposed on the internet, anyone who looks at this evidence can come to no other conclusion.
Oh, where was I going with this? There was another one real recently. Oh, the State of the Union address. I don't remember the name of the woman that was seated next to Michelle Obongo, that they kept referring, like, oh, this woman a bunch of years ago.
No, that wasn't fake. That was a real disaster.
Well, the State of the Union was a disaster. I guarantee the State of the Union is a disaster. But
it was the speech was just purely fictional.
Yeah, the woman that they were claiming wrote the president a letter about how hard the last 6 years had been. None of that actually happened. They researched who this woman was, and Rush Limbaugh blew the lid on it. She was a longtime Democrat campaign operative, and I guarantee you, she's making plenty of money. The last 6 years have not been hard for Democrat paid operatives. I guarantee you that. It's the amount of just fake everything in this society is so utterly shocking when you find out about it.
But it all fits in because the Jews control the society and everything the Jews do is fake.
Yeah, there's absolutely no substance to any of it, as I remarked in a recent RFN episode. And on that note, I've been trying to organize behind the scenes a little project since we're doing back to basics stuff for our new audience on the All Nationalist Network. One of the things I've wanted to have done is for longtime party associates to discuss what first brought them to white nationalism and how they found the party and the things that eventually convinced them that they needed to participate in the Northwest Imperative. And I've got Don and AJ here, so I figure I'll open the floor up for that.
Myself, really was raised with my eyes open. I grew up in the Northeast, let's say, and there were significant German communities before World War I, and that spirit just really still survived to the point it was around when I was a child. And I saw this, I remember speaking with older people, and just hearing about all the filth that the Jews put out, and it was just reality at the time.
You know, what I find interesting about that is, I won't go get it, but one of the books on my shelf behind us was written in the 50s by a college professor of, I think, history or political science or something, and it was one of those, something to the effect of, when are we going to stop pretending that this Holocaust thing happened? You know, can we get over it already? This wasn't real. Time to drop the propaganda. The war's over. That was something that was recommended to me off of the party's reading list, and the eye-opening that happens when you see someone else's perspective from I guess now you would say that's almost a couple generations ago, to see the way people talked about these events shortly after they happened, and the way we talk about them now is baffling to someone raised in a politically correct society.
Yeah, I mean, when I grew up to say, I got Jewed at this or that, was absolutely nothing. Now, if you say it, they look at you like you got three heads. There's nothing wrong with the word nigger, nothing wrong with the word kike. They're there for a reason.
Stereotypes are stereotypes for a reason.
Well, it's even the word Jew. I mean, that's not a politically incorrect word unless you use it to say so-and-so is a Jew. If you use it to identify people as Jews, that makes them uncomfortable, so they don't like that.
It's almost like using the word liberal. We had to swap out the word liberal for progressive about 10 years ago or so, which is funny because everything those people do is going to drive us back to the Stone Age. But all right, say so you were raised white nationalist, AJ.
I wouldn't say white nationalist per se, okay. But just a real mentality.
Did people even think of themselves as racist, or was it just a matter of they thought they were being honest?
Just being honest, and I think that's maybe my point here. It's not even so much white nationalism, it's just honesty. I mean, you call a spade.
Literally.
Yeah.
The younger listeners, and I'm thinking people my age and younger, might not realize that spade used to be a term for nigger. So, go figure. I've run into people older than me, although just one or two, when they use that phrase, let's say in company where they shouldn't have, and they got funny looks from the rest of the room, and I had to explain to them that, well, we don't say that because...
Yeah, you know, the original derivation of that is that you'd say this guy is black as the ace of spades, and the use of the word spade became another way of saying nigger.
Interesting. So, all right, being raised in what you would refer to as an honest way, at what point would you say you made the transition to nationalism and why?
I'd say looking at the war in Bosnia, going back to the Clinton era at this point, well, why don't these people have a right for their own determination? Then kind of turn the table to myself. Well, why don't whites have a right to their own determination? And they do.
Something I remarked in a very recent episode of RFN that's probably aired immediately prior to your hearing this, audience, is that I've noticed, in having spoken with several other white nationalists, that we tend to not think of our own interests first, and we only come around to white nationalism after we realize that, hey, we don't like the way that person over there or that group over there is being treated, and we surround ourselves with a sense of right and wrong long enough to realize that, well, hey, wait a second, we're not being treated correctly either. And I always thought that was interesting, that the white mind tends to start off with the assumption of, well, we can't possibly be in any danger from other groups, even though other groups start off with the assumption that we're in danger from white people.
Well, the difference between our approach and the Jews' approach is, when we approach something, we look at, well, what's the truth, what's right, and what's happening? And the Jews are always, how can we manipulate this situation to our advantage? And they do it by saying things, and it's like, I don't think they even consider it lying, they're just... What words will get me what I want, and then they'll say those words, and the fact that those words are a lie just doesn't even cross their mind.
What's right even at my own expense would be the Aryan philosophy, and
yeah.
What's good for me even at the expense of the truth would be the Jewish philosophy.
Except I don't think they'd even say at the expense of the truth. They just think, okay, they're manipulators, and they manipulate people by manipulating words and visual images, which is why they took over Hollywood, and they... Again, ask themselves, if they do this consciously, what words will get me what I want, and then they'll use those words. And whether it's true or not just is irrelevant in their thinking.
I had to explain a little bit different. In the mind of a Jew, they're always taught to ask, is it good for the Jews? Where white people, we don't even have that concept, but maybe we should start adopting that. Is it good for whites?
Well, now that's interesting, because if white nationalists would adopt what's good for whites, they would adopt the Butler Plan and the Northwest Imperative, and I would be able to turn around and look at the street in Seattle where I live and see a few of you guys driving in with your moving vans. But as such, I turn around and don't see you, so get on that, would you? Sorry, had to throw that in. That's kind of my job.
Yeah.
Well, to be truthful, it's not that difficult to get here. I did it on a shoestring budget from the Northeast. Came out on a Greyhound the first time for a scouting trip.
Oh, by the way, folks, scouting trips, please. They're a whole lot more important than just a meet and greet.
Yes. On my scouting trip, I found the place that I am living now. There are things that you need to do, practical things, and the scouting trip is a great time to do it. It's the best time to do it, actually.
It's a whole lot better than needing to scramble after you roll up with a truck and whatever else you have that you brought here. that's not the time to wonder where you're going to land.
Yeah, for myself, came out on a scouting trip. I had a complex, apartment complex all hooked up. By the time I came out here, I had my lease in hand, knew where everything was going, all my moving stuff was taken care of. I took a sleeper out on the Amtrak. It was great.
I've noticed people that put the effort into organizing their move to that level seem to have very little trouble pulling any of it off.
Yeah. Well, let me tell a little story here about my coming around to white nationalism. I would say that for the longest time, there was a, what you call cognitive dissonance or something, between my emotional and almost subconscious and instinctual feelings and desires, which were for my people, and on the other hand, what I was being taught. And there was this intellectual stuff being thrown at me, that like the Holocaust and various other things. And the end result was that there was this conflict, and I felt very uncomfortable. And the older I got, and the more I learned, and the more I did, the more experience I had, the more I was moving toward what eventually has become, of course, white nationalism on my part. But it was a gradual thing for me. It was like a gradual moving away from all the indoctrination I received as a child and a young person, and gradually having my eyes opened. I would say that the internet was a huge help, which came later in my life since I'm in my late 60s. The end result was, it was a gradual process for me. Some people have this one thing that happens and bam, the scales fall away, then they have an epiphany, they understand, and they're on track. But for me, it was a gradual thing, and I also noticed along the way, people couldn't be completely explicit about it, but when I was in university, I was a member of a Viking club, and this sort of thing. You get bits and pieces, and you get strong hints and suggestions, all this sort of thing. It was my experience growing up. Of course, I grew up through the 60s with the civil rights movements, and feminism hitting its stride, and political correctness taking over, all this sort of thing. And you could see that there was something wrong here, and people would say, oh, this is so wonderful. Well, then, you know, why doesn't it feel wonderful? Why aren't the results so wonderful? The whole idea that white people deserved to be treated as well as anybody else by the government and by society in general is a notion that some people have trouble with, and I had to struggle with a little bit. But I thought, no, it's not fair that we should be pushed down any more than it's fair, like the civil rights activists would say, that other people should be pushed down. And when they talk about equality, okay, how is affirmative action equality? It's not. It's giving a group of people who are considered special, they need special treatment, special help, special advantages, and it's all because you, people like you, you're so evil, and when's it going to stop? I mean, this was started during the 60s, and I remember, and I thought, it's supposed to be temporary. It's, yeah, it's supposed to be temporary. I have had my head beaten in, so finally I've learned to not believe literally anything that any politician says. That's not an exaggeration. It's all a pack of lies, and that's a little aside here in the story, but you literally can't trust any of that stuff. You can't trust the government, you can't trust the politicians, you can't trust the bureaucrats who run the government. It's all manipulation of the people, and they are like Jews in that they say whatever gets them what they want. They don't consider truth or falsehood. It's just what words will, you know, get me what I want. That's how they operate, too. And, of course, the Jews control the government and the media, so we're exposed to this all the time.
That's all the time we have for today's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. You can also go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. Hail victory, comrades. We'll see you next week. Well,